is Carl.
We good? Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank Cynthia for asking me to come out here. My sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. I'm from Covina, California, where the self-proclaimed sobriety capital of the world. I know you guys think you are. We think we are. It's always good to see Peggy and Marlena and Ava. Anyway, I want to welcome the people that are new. The most important thing I can tell you about myself is that I'm an alcoholic. I could tell you a lot of other things about myself that I have tried to be, that I succeed at, that I aspire to be in my life, but the most important thing, the defining factor of who Carl is that I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober over half my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and whether I was drunk or sober, the fact that I'm an alcoholic is what drives my bus. It's what makes my decisions. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really a very simple thing. It's not very complicated at all. The reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is because I have a really bizarre relationship with alcohol. That's why I'm an alcoholic. And the strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink booze. The book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says that the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink booze is what they refer to as the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It happens with nothing else. An example of that is they're kind enough to put these waters up here for me, and probably over the next, I guess I have 28 more minutes to talk with you. I will probably drink at least half this bottle of water. Maybe I'll finish it, but I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish this bottle of water, I am not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in a hotel room. There is no chance of that happening. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, then Just Say No would have wiped out alcoholism, right? Early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, Just Say No. I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, ha ha, no. And just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I've got this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol, and that happens when I'm not drinking it. Even by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, I seem to have this mind that is able to paint a picture that makes it okay to take another drink no matter what the pain, humiliation, and suffering was a day, a week, or a month ago. And it never enters into the equation whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. I could care less. But sooner or later, my mind is able to rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So I can't drink successfully because of this bizarre physical reaction that I get, but I cannot, on my own, not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. Because I swear to you, if I could do either one of those two things, I would. Right? I'm going to harp on that physical feature a little bit more because it's the one thing, bar none, we all have in common. Because you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous, really, it's hard to hear your story if you're listening to the wrong things because we really are a giant, wide cross-section of society. This room represents it very well. I mean, every race, creed, color, religion, educational background, or no education, right? Good family, bad family, we're all here. In fact, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where the bank president, the bank teller, and the bank robber are all right here in the same room. And they all have a very different perception of what just happened, right? So our stories are different on that level, right, because of our different backgrounds, but we also drink differently than each other if we really look at it. To illustrate that, let's say we cracked open these back doors and right up the middle aisle here, I don't want to get anybody thirsty, but let's say we cracked open the back doors and right up this middle aisle, we brought in a giant cart of all the kind of booze we love, right? If you're a top shelf drinker, we got it. Some Remy Martin, Cavassier, we got it, right? If you're a bottom shelf drinker, we got that too. Mad Dog 2020, we got it all, right? And everything in between. And if all of us took about four or five good stiff drinks, right? Stiff drinks, real drinks, no umbrellas, no spritzer, good four or five stiff drinks. We would all be acting very, very differently, right? Over in this corner, we'd have the good time crowd. Woohoo! Talk, 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 talk. Ha ha. Hey, next bar. Hey, woo, right? Let's go, let's go, let's go. All over town. We're going, right? Over in that corner, we'd have the sobbers. They don't even leave the house. Woo! Over in this corner, we got the fighters, right? Fighting. Over here, a bunch of us would be naked. I personally would be visiting each corner trying to find a couple of friends to go over here with me. So our stories are different on that level too, right? Over here in the good time crowd, they always get the DUIs, or you might call them DWIs here, right? They're always, hey, come on, next bar, who's going after hours? Hey, stop at the liquor store, we're going over to Fred's. Hey, we're going to be there at 2 a.m., right? So they're always getting arrested on the road. Over here in the sobbing corner, no DUIs, they don't even leave the house. Just, the worst they do is like late night drunk dialing. Or God forbid these days, drunk Facebooking. Over in the fighting corner, they always probation, parole, court dates, attorneys always in their story. Over here, a bunch of children show up by surprise. Right. So our stories are all different on that level too. But no matter which corner we're in, there's one thing we would all be doing. We would all be back at the cart for another drink. Right? And so I really needed to understand that in order to learn how to listen in Alcoholics Anonymous so I could not have to pick and choose whether I identify with you on the facts of your life, but on the two things that make me alcoholic, what happens to me when I drink and what happens to me when on my own I try not to drink. I set this relationship up with alcohol right from the get-go when I first started drinking. I started drinking very late in life compared to most. I was 11. I lived in Seattle. By the time I'm 14, my hair is down onto my shoulders. My vocabulary at 14 was, whoa, whoa, right? By the time I'm 22, this little story I'm about to let you know, I will kind of let you know exactly where alcoholism took me. By the time I was 22, and I don't know whether this, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear, that's why. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. Another impressive year, I'm sure. The next paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves the golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. They were actually being very kind. I'm going to fast forward. A really ugly night happens. I wind up in the Navy. It was that bad of a night. Year and a half into the Navy, they've got me on Anabuse. And I got to tell you, Anabuse, when you give an alcoholic of my type and you give him something that is supposed to stop me from drinking. You see, at various times in my life, various authority figures had been taking alcohol away from me. And I was agreeing with him. The price was getting high. I wasn't arguing. I would say, yeah, I agree. I'm not happy the car's on fire either. I'm on your side. But here's what I just didn't know how to describe. If you realized how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink. And I didn't know how to verbalize that. And that's what was really killing me on the inside, this restlessness, irritability, and discontentment, this complete separation from until I would have a drink, and then all of a sudden, I'm there. And you guys are now taking alcohol away from me in various forms. I'm going to get sober here real quick. I was 25. The military had me on Anabuse. That makes my drinking extremely colorful. Basically, what happens is I would have this stuff called projectile regurgitation, just sort of projectiled across the room. I would drink in this hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. It's handy when you have to throw up on Anabuse to have the toilet right there. So I drank on Anabuse the last 7 months of my drinking, and the military threw me into a military treatment center. I came out of that treatment center knowing only one thing after 45 days, that when they took us to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys were speaking a language I had never heard before, but I understood it. It was the most bizarre thing I had ever experienced in my life. You guys understood those two things. You told stories about exactly how I drank. And even more importantly, you described the way I felt when I wasn't drinking. I'll never forget, at my very first meeting, this guy got called on. He walked all the way to the front. The meetings in Southern California are really big, just like this. Guy walked all the way to the front. He said, "My name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation." And he walked back and I was like, exactly. But what I didn't understand when I got out of that treatment center, so I'm sitting in a meeting fresh out of that treatment center, and I'm 45 days without a drink. I had a lot of information, and I was physically feeling better than I had felt since I'd been a young teenager. But there had been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And what was even more dangerous than that is I did not know I needed one. I didn't understand what that meant, that I needed to have a drastic rearrangement of my ideas and outlook on life. And I couldn't have described I didn't understand that I had a spiritual relationship to alcohol too. I didn't understand that, and I actually couldn't have described it to you until I was like 13 years sober. That's the only way that I can describe it, is to tell this story. And I didn't understand it as I sat there with 45 days, but by telling you this story when I was 13 years sober, maybe it'll get that idea across to you. It was the year 2000. My mom called me and said, "Hey, your brother and his wife and his kids are in the south of France for the summer. Let's go visit them, and we'll go to Iceland also on the way." And I'm in. Sure, I'll go. So we went to Iceland, and a phenomenal experience there. I've actually been back 4 or 5 times back to Iceland since the year 2000. But that's not the point of the story. We go to visit my brother in the south of France. He's there for the summer with his wife and kids. Remember, Microsoft money? No resentment from me here. And we're visiting him there. And one of the nights, my brother says, "My treat, I'm taking everybody out for a 13-course French meal. And Carl, you're driving." So I drive, and we go there. And if you've never had a 13-course French meal, like I hadn't before, if you've never had a 13-course French meal, what they do is they bring you a little bit of food 13 times. Yes, they do. Right? And we're sitting in this beautiful courtyard in the chateau in the French countryside. And each time they bring you this little bit of food, they also bring you this tiny, tiny little glass of wine. Embarrassingly small glass of wine. And they tell you a story about the vineyard and the family behind the vineyard. And my brother and his wife are, trying those. My mom's tried one or two. But my brother and his wife are having a good time, and they're drinking it. Now, I'm already 13 years sober, so I'm trying all the Diet Cokes of the region. kept asking, "Is there a story about this, too?" No. But anyway, my brother and his wife, they recognize a good drinking opportunity, so they're having a good time. But my mother, after just 2 tiny little glasses of wine, says to the waiter, "No more for me." And I look at her, "Mom, come on, have a couple more, for God's sake. I'm driving." And she says, no. And I've heard her say this before. It's not news to me. She goes, "No, I don't like the way it makes me feel." Now, I should have left well enough alone. I really should have just changed the conversation and gone up. But for whatever reason, I really said, it just piqued my interest this time. I said, "Mom, how does it make you feel?" And she goes, well, "Carl, I'm sitting here in like a once-in-a-lifetime experience, sitting here looking at the brilliant colors of the French countryside at sunset. I'm listening to the string quartet, and oh, it's just rattling my bones. And I'm here talking to 3 of the people I love the most in the world. And if I were to drink a little bit too much alcohol, the colors start to get blurry and sloppy. The music starts to sound shallow and off in the distance, and I have a hard time keeping a conversation going with you." Do you get that? That is fundamentally the opposite relationship to alcohol than I have. Because what she's saying is, up and by herself, she sees the colors of life, she hears the music, and she can connect with God's other people. If she drinks a little bit too much alcohol, it gets blurry, sloppy, and boring. Me, of and by myself, I cannot see the colors of life. I can't hear the music, and you're pretty damn boring. I get 4 or 5 drinks in me, and oh, look at the colors. Look, look. Oh, do you hear that music? I could tell you where that cello was made, whether I know or not. I can make up the name of a German village on the spot. And you become very interesting, but not as interesting as me. I have my spirit, that thing that's inside of me that's trying to communicate with you right now, I have a spiritual relationship with alcohol. That had died. I needed that to be awakened without alcohol, or I don't get to stay. I truly believe that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, is to awaken that spirit to life again without alcohol. And that's what the steps are designed to do. That's what commitments are supposed to do. That's what sponsorship does. That's the whole point of this whole thing. So anyway, I'm sitting in that meeting fresh out of that treatment center, and I don't know anybody, and I'm 45 days without a drink, and this one guy operating on his primary purpose that night came back to me and said, "Hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing?" I didn't think quick enough to lie to him, because I swear to you, if I would have thought for one more second, I would have lied to him, and I accidentally told him the truth. And I said, "I don't know. I just got out of a Navy treatment center earlier today. I don't know what I'm doing." This guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. At the break, he's fighting his friends off. He's mine. I got him. Mine. I didn't know you mark your newcomers around here. But there was something else going on in this guy's life that particular weekend that made him especially glad to meet me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. So he was wondering what he was going to do with his weekend. Homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was insane over this woman. In between the meetings, he'd throw him in the passenger side of his car, he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling, "Go, you gotta go to me, you gotta read the book, you gotta get a sponsor, damn her!" And I'm like, ah. Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so very glad that that guy, that night, in his pain, was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore understood that his solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. By going to so many meetings with that guy, fresh out of that treatment center, in the same area of town, I learned something really valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't understand. By going to so many meetings, I saw other people that were at multiple meetings over that weekend. Now, I didn't see anybody else doing 18 meetings, just me and that guy. But I saw other people that were at two or three meetings over that weekend. And what I learned about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason and one reason only, to win the game. And how do they win that game? They huddle up, they make a plan, and they do one play. Then they huddle up again, they make another plan, and they do one play. It's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the game around here is one day without a drink, you're a big winner. And how do we do that? One day. We run in here and we huddle up. And we remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Break! And we go out there and we try a little of this, and we try a little of that, and we run right back in here and we huddle up. We go, remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. And just before we break, some guy in the corner might go, wait, I'm sober. I've got 6 months. But I'm broken, I'm bored, what do I do? Some old-timer will say, son, get a job. Break! And we go out here and we try a little of that. Got back to my ship after that weekend, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. He became my first sponsor even before I asked him. Just the nerve of that guy. But he understood. He thought I was like gold being delivered to him on a silver platter. Right? And he was all over me. And I'm just really, really grateful for this man. He's also the one that made me meet him way down in the bottom of the ship every night when the ship was out at sea, and he would read that book to me. I still remember the first night I showed up, and he threw that book on the table. He goes, "I've been hounding about it for a while. Have you read it?" And I said, like, yeah. There's like how it works. There's we antagonists. There's some doctor with some opinion about something. And he just had 14 more months than me. Right? And he was just trying to save his own life. So I look back at that time, two guys on the USS Cushing, DD-985, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, two guys with the big book trying to have an experience with the big book. We didn't even know what that experience would be. It literally, You know, it was the blind leading the blind. Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. And he died sober with cancer about 8 years ago, and he was still 14 months ahead of me. The other thing that I learned right about this time is, and I'll never forget it, is that there's this magic in Alcoholics Anonymous of one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic that happens nowhere else. It's the thing that binds us together in like no other organization or movement at all. It's that idea of one alcoholic sharing with another, and that is how I learned that. My first sponsor, Bob, and I would often split hotel rooms when the ship would pull into a foreign port, and just to get off the ship, and we would find the meetings. This particular time, we're in Victoria, British Columbia, and we got the hotel room, then we went out to the AA clubhouse to go to a meeting, and after the meeting, my first sponsor, Bob, said, you know, I'm not feeling well. I'm going to head back to the ship. I stayed out with the AAers, maybe went to coffee, maybe went to another meeting, I'm not sure, but about an hour and a half later, a couple hours later, I come back to the room, and Bob had found another guy from our ship named Blair, and Blair was wasted, right? And Blair has vomit down his front, and his hair is all out, you know, and he's been on a day and a half drunk, and Bob has him on my bed, right, propped up against the headboard with like an end table and a chair, and Bob is reading the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous to him. And I walk in, and I see this, and I think, this is ridiculous. Blair's like, and Bob is there. We are more than 100 men and women who have seemingly come. I think this is ridiculous, but I throw my 10 cents in, and then we carry Blair back to the ship on our shoulders, make sure he's safe, and put him away. That's the last I hear from Blair for a couple of weeks, maybe even 3 weeks. And all of a sudden, we're back in port in San Diego, and it's in the middle of the night. I'm in my rack on the ship, and it's in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden I hear, no, and I'm like, what? And it's Bob, and he pulls the curtain back, and he goes, Get up. Now, what? Carl, Blair's on the Coronado Bridge. We got to go get him. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Coronado Bridge, but it's the most popular suicide spot on the West Coast. So popular that they have a suicide hotline phone up at the top just in case you change your mind. They're hoping your feet are still on the bridge when you do change your mind. So he goes, come on. And apparently Blair had been trying not to drink over the last few weeks, and now he's apparently at the jumping off place, and he is up there on the bridge. And apparently earlier in the evening, this is what Blair was doing. He had gotten onto the suicide hotline phone. And the very well-qualified, well-meaning suicide hotline counselor on the other end was saying, he was telling the counselor, Blair was saying, I will only talk to Bob W. The well-meaning counselor was saying, who's Bob W? Blair was saying, it's anonymous. She goes and gets her supervisor, another well-meaning, highly qualified suicide counselor, and they start doing the good cop, bad cop, firing questions, confusing them. They find out he's from the Navy and what ship he's from. So they just take a shot in the dark, and they call down to the quarterdeck of our ship at 3 a.m. in the morning, and they say, is there a Bob W. on the ship? Now, my first sponsor would guard your anonymity at the level of that ship, but he did not guard his own so he could be of service at any time. So the guy who answered the phone at 3 a.m. said, yeah, Mr. 12 Steps, we know all about him. So they go and get Bob. Bob comes to get me. Wake up, Carl. All right. And so we hop into Bob's car. He goes, come on, we're going down to the Coronado Bridge. And so we hop into his car at 3 a.m. As we're driving, Bob looks at me and goes, hey, Carl, grab the big book out of the glove box. Bone up on working with others. Like, all right. Then he says, forget it. We're going to wing it this time. So we get down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and everything that society has available for a situation like this is there. The on-duty, the fire department is there, the police are there, the paramedics are there, the on-duty psychologist is there. They've got this rigged up communication thing with him, and Bob and I walk up on the scene, and the fireman who seems to be in charge says, is one of you Bob W? And Bob goes, yeah, that's me. He goes, I don't know what you're going to do. We've been talking for an hour and a half. He's not getting down. But here, give it a shot. Hands him this little speakerphone contraption, and Bob goes, Blair? And you can hear on the other end, Bob, is that you? Bob says, yes, Blair, it's me, and I get the hell down from that bridge. Here. Okay. One alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like no one else can. Don't forget that. We need to take our seats in our meetings. We need to keep our commitments in the meetings because nobody can help us but us. When we decide that our life is too busy to be continuing to take our seats, it means we are absolutely spitting whatever it is that runs this universe right in the face to one of the most beautiful gifts we have ever been given. 2 years sober, got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That is the result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, an apparently merciful God, and a personnelman that lost half my file. That's how that happened. And everything I owned, I threw into this car. I still had this 68 Volkswagen that I was push starting, and I was puttering on up the Los Angeles freeways. Because one of the amends that I had to make that I could not make while I was still in the Navy, my first sponsor and his sponsor were real sticklers about that ninth step. One of the amends that I could not make while I was still in the Navy was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree back when I was 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. Right? I spent like 4 years in a university and got about 10 credits is what I got. Right? So I didn't have the degree, and I was given two choices. You either have to pay them back every single nickel that they wasted on your degree, or you have to go get what they paid for in the first place. So I'm driving up to this town called Covina in the Los Angeles area with everything in my car, puttering, and I started to think, you know what? I need to get a life. I need to get a life. I've heard people talk about having a life in AA. I need one, and I'm going to work hard. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to work. You know, I'm not going to have much time to go to meetings. I'm going to get a life, and then I'll get active again in AA, and I'm puttering up, right? And I pulled into this AA clubhouse in Covina, and I went to the noon meeting just to see where the meetings were in case I needed one. And I needed to get another sponsor because my last sponsor was still in the Navy, had 2 more years to do, and they were going to Asia. But I wasn't actively thinking about getting another sponsor. I'm thinking about I need a life first. And the man making coffee that day walked up to me and said, "Son, never." Same thing that guy said to me fresh out of treatment. "Son, never seen you here before. What are you doing?" This time I had a much better answer. I said, "Sir, I'm 2 years... 2 years sober, fresh out of the United States Navy, and I'm going to be going to school. I'm going to be working. You won't see me much because I'm going to be real busy. I got to get a life." And I am so glad this man, even not knowing me, treated me like a real alcoholic and understood that my solutions need to be based on spiritual principles rather than real life ideas. And he just chuckled and he said, "Oh, school and work, that's wonderful. But that's what we do in between meetings, son." And what he was really telling me is that I need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world, instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visiting Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient. First thing he told me to do was put new guys in that car. I objected at first and said, "I've got a hole in the floor, but I have to push start the thing." He said, "Put new guys in your car, your life will get better." Since he was 10 years sober when I was born, I thought I'd give it a try. And the very first night that I put new guys in my car, I realized this man had not lied to me at all. My life got better. The very first night I put new guys in my car, I remember after the meeting looking over my shoulder, my life got better. The new guys were push-starting my car for me. Didn't say how much better, he just said better. I have to tell you that in the 28 years that I've been here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have found a life that I did not even know was available for a guy like me. I didn't even know life could mean this much. I really don't. I have a really big... I just got to say it. Remember the sister I told you about that graduated from Cornell University? She's sitting right here with me tonight. She lives here in... She lives here in this beautiful city of yours. It's a pleasure to have her here. I also have these two beautiful kids. I got married at 17 years sober. The marriage did not work out. I know you've never heard about that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know what? We've worked out an amicable situation to be good co-parents. She's a good mom, and we've worked out an amicable situation. And these kids, man, oh, my goodness. I've never known I could love somebody that much. Really. It's really, the forefront of my mind is I want to be a good dad. But without you guys, I don't even get a chance. Right? I would never trade my kids for the first drink. Not in a million years. But I'm alcoholic. I know what it means to be alcoholic. Although I would never trade them for the first drink, I would trade them for the second drink like that. There's no doubt in my mind. So there is nothing that is more important than me staying in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. No ifs, ands, or buts. I can't be a good dad without you guys. I really, really can't. And the things that I learn from you guys on a daily basis, what happened, this is why I keep coming back. I have this little tuning fork inside, right inside here. And man, when I hear a real alcoholic sharing honestly about their struggles with life and their solutions to life, that tuning fork just goes, and I connect with you guys like I connect nowhere else on the planet. Then every once in a while, somebody starts talking the way they do sometimes in meeting, goes, right? But then I just sit there and smile anyway, because the next person gets me humming again, right? And that's why I keep coming to you people, because I don't identify with the rest of the planet. I do in many ways, but there's something about you guys that makes me feel like I'm at home when I walk in the room. Thank you very much.